We've had some introduction to Krishna already. This introduction will continue to the end of the 11th chapter of this first canto. But we've already seen how Krishna protects his devotees on two occasions, more than that. He's protected Arjuna's life, saving him from the Brahmastra. He's protected the Pandavas, even a family quarrel amongst the Pandavas. He solved what to do with this aswatam. And then he protected the 5 Pandavas from the Brahmastra. And he protected Maharaj Prickett, the unborn child, in a wonderful way. Because we may think that Krishna was right in front of the Pandavas. He was upon a chariot. So therefore he could easily protect them because he's all powerful. But here I am. Maybe I'm sitting in Perth, Australia, or some far corner of the world. How will Krishna protect me? Separated by time, separated by space. But no, mama angsa tejo sambhava. There is no place that is separated from Krishna. Because with just a fragment of himself, he pervades and supports the entirety of the universe. So he's everywhere. So he was already there with Maharaj Prickett in the womb. He was already there. There is no place where he's not. And therefore he just expanded his energy. And now Krishna is preparing to leave. As he gets upon his chariot, and this won't be the last time Krishna is preparing to leave, because he doesn't leave so easily. Why doesn't Krishna leave so easily? Why? The devotees don't let him just stay one more day, one more day only, or one more month. Why? It is not artificial, it is not a formality. They just love him so dearly. But that causes a problem. What's the problem that it causes? We'll hear about this very soon. That as the residents of Hastinapur are begging Krishna to stay, the residents of Dwarka are crying. And then when the residents of Hastinapur start crying, the residents of Dwarka become very happy. They're not happy because the residents of Hastinapur are crying, because Krishna is entering their city. But yet, how wonderful it is that Krishna is so strongly there in the hearts of his devotees when they are feeling this deep separation from him. He's fully present there. So he was just about to, he was on his chariot, and Kunti Devi began to offer prayers. Who is Kunti Devi? Yes. Sister Vasudev, who else? So many identities. Mother of the Pandavas. Yes. And devotee of Krishna also. So she began to speak to Krishna, and her words were very, very sweet and very wonderful, and they carried deep meaning. And of course, they're instructive to us. They gradually unfold in their meaning and purpose. Note that in the 7th chapter, the 23rd verse, Arjuna said, Tum adya purusham purushat shakshad. You are the original, directly the original personality. Ishvara prakriti para. The controller, the supreme controller of the prakriti, of the material energy. Yes. of the material nature. And here, Kunti Devi begins. Kunti Uvacha, this is text 18. Namasye Purusham Tvadyam Ishvara Prakriti Param Alaksham Savabhutanam Antarbahiravastitam. So, Namasye Purusham Tvadyam Tvadya Purusha Shakshad. So, Kunti Devi, Namasye, she is offering her obeisances, bowing down to whom? Because this person was her nephew. But yet, she wasn't just bowing down and offer obeisances to her nephew. This was Purusham Tvadyam. You are the original Purusha. You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ishvaram Prakriti Param. Same words. You are the controller, the supreme controller of the material nature. Just see this amazing situation that this person who is the controller of the entirety of the material nature, and that's a huge amount to control. Just look up at night sometime, not in the rainy season, but you'll see so many stars in the sky. Hundreds, thousands, practically no one can count the stars in the sky. And that's just one small portion of the material energy. A small, small portion of the material energy, because there are so many universes. What to speak of the totality of existence? Because the material energy is considered ekabada vibhuti. It's one quarter of the totality. And that, of course, is just an estimate to give us an idea, like Chandra Shaka Nyaya. What does Chandra Shaka Nyaya mean? Yeah, Chandra means the moon and Shaka means a branch. Nyaya, the logic of the moon and the branch. So if we say, someone says, where is the moon? You point, oh, it's just above that branch. So the person can look at the branch and then get an idea of where the moon is. There's the moon over there. But the moon, of course, isn't directly on the branch or above the branch. It's so far away. But it's pointing in the direction. So this material nature is considered one quarter of the totality, but what's one quarter of unlimited infinite? It can't really be measured. But just to give us an idea of how great the spiritual world is, even compared to the greatness of the material world, this example is given. So that person who is the original controller, the creator and the controller of the entirety of the material nature, he's seated upon this chariot directly in front of Kunti Devi. How wonderful. He's unlimited, but yet he has a form, a very well-known form to Kunti Devi. So how could someone with a form be unlimited? Because a form means you're limited in one sense. Because my form is right here on these two cushions. And that means it's not over there. If it's over here, it's not over there. If it's this height, it's not way over there. If it has two arms, it doesn't have unlimited arms. That's material logic. Because in the material world, form is a limiting factor. But with Krishna, he is unlimited despite his form. So when we try to apply the limitations of material logic to the spiritual world, we end up being an impersonalist. But Krishna is sitting right in front of Kunti Devi on a chariot. How is it possible that the source of all the material and spiritual worlds could be sitting on a chariot? Obviously, the wheels would be crushed. After all, how heavy is everything, and it's on these two wheels or four wheels of the chariot. We can apply material logic to understand Krishna. He is inconceivable, achintya shakti. There is no meaning to God if He is forced to stay within our finite logic, within our finite, tiny, insignificant, limited capacity to understand. God, by definition, is greater than everything, especially our tiny ability to understand. If He could fit within our finite logics, He would not be God. So He is the Ishwaram, Prakriti, Param, the Supreme Controller, and He's right there. And she is a great devotee. She loves Him so dearly. Alaksham sarvabhutanam antar bahir avastitam. Alaksham, you're invisible, although you are the Supreme Controller of the material nature. Alaksham sarvabhutanam, all the living entities, they cannot understand you, they cannot see you, you are invisible to their eyes, although antar bahir avastitam, you exist outside of everything and inside of everything, but yet no one can see you. Now Kunti Devi has just noted this fact. She saw that Krishna was outside, personally standing, two arm, protecting the Pandavas from the Brahmastra of Aswatthama, but yet at exactly the same time He was inside Uttara protecting the unborn child Maharaj Prickett within the womb by expanding His energy. And we heard the description of how, what were His eyes like? Anyone remember what His eyes were like? Yeah, they were definitely lotus-like, but they were very hot. They were red with fury because He was angry that His devotee, Maharaj Prickett, was being attacked. Like when Narada Muni came to protect Prahlad Maharaj from the demigods. When Hiranyakashipu was performing austerities, the demigods wanted to kill the unborn child within the womb. Narada Muni stopped them. He said, "You don't try and kill him, and even if you tried, you couldn't. Because even though he is the son of Hiranyakashipu, he is a great devotee. You would not be able to kill him." Hiranyakashipu tried so many times to kill Prahlad. He couldn't. So Krishna was there to protect. And the sum total of Krishna's anger actually came to kill Hiranyakashipu. As Lord Nisringadev, he was so furious because his devotee was being threatened. This is the nature of the loving relationship between Krishna and his devotee. Prabhupada's the translation. Srimati Kunti Devi said, Kunti said, "O Krishna, I offer my obeisances unto you, because you are the original personality and are unaffected by the qualities of the material world." Why is he unaffected? Because he is the Ishwara. He is not under them. He is above them. Like the king, when he enters the prison house, he is unaffected by the laws of the prison. He is above the laws of the prison. He has made the laws of the prison. He evokes the laws of the prison. Ishwara Prakriti Param. You are existing both within and without everything. Yet, although you are everywhere, you are invisible to all. This is amazing. Someone or something is everywhere, but no one can see him. This we'll get to later. And therefore, the materialists say, "Oh, mythology, he's everywhere, but no one can see him." Very good. Then what's the difference between him being everywhere and nowhere? which is the step between impersonalism and atheism. Not a very big step at all. Prabhupada's purport we'll read from about halfway through, where it begins, "He is the Param Ishwar, or the Supersoul. He is both within and without. Although he was present before Srimati Kunti as her nephew, he was also within her and everyone else. At this very moment, Krishna is within each and every one in this room. And therefore, the Vaishnavas are naturally very respectful to every living entity. Krishna is at this very moment in everyone's heart and between every atom, and therefore Vaishnava is respectful to everything." In the Bhagavad Gita 15:15, the Lord says, "I am situated in everyone's heart, and only due to me one remembers, forgets, and is cognizant, etc. Through all the Vedas I am to be known, because I am the compiler of the Vedas and I am the teacher of the Vedanta." So we already know who is the compiler of the Vedas. We just heard in the last chapters how Srila Vyasadeva, so Krishna as Srila Vyasadeva, compiles the Vedas. And he knows the Vedas, so he can say, "Vedes chasavar, aham eva vidyo." He knows the Vedas, so he can say that by the Vedas I am to be known. He compiled the Vedanta, the Vedas, etc. Queen Kunti affirms that the Lord, although both within and without all living beings, is still invisible. The Lord is, so to speak, a puzzle for the common man. Queen Kunti experienced personally that the Lord was present before her, yet he entered within the womb of Uttara to save her embryo from the attack of Aswatthama's Brahmastra. Kunti herself was puzzled about whether Sri Krishna is all-pervasive or localized. In fact, he is both, but he reserves the right of not being exposed to persons who are not surrendered souls. This checking curtain, Prabhupada means that which checks or stops or inhibits our ability to see Krishna, although he is everywhere, but we see him nowhere. This is the unfortunateness of our situation. He is everywhere, and we see him nowhere. Why? What stops us? The checking curtain is called the Maya energy of the Lord, and it controls the limited vision of the rebellious souls. It is explained as follows. Because the next question one asks, Kunti Devi says, "Anta bahira vastita, you're inside everything, you're outside of everything, yet alakshasava bhutanam, yet no one can see you, all living entities remain separate from you, can't see you. What is the cause of that? What kind of mysterious person are you that you're everywhere but no one can see you?" And her next prayer answers that question. How is it possible that someone could be inside, outside, everywhere, but yet at the same time invisible? What makes him invisible? Maya javani kachanam agyadarokshajamavyayam nalakshase mudadrisha nato natyadaroyata. Everyone. Maya javani kachanam agyadarokshajamavyayam nalakshase mudadrisha nato natyadaro yata. Maya javani katshanam. Javanika, curtain. Maya, the deluding energy. Achanam, covered by. This is the reason. Because the curtain of Krishna's Maya Shakti It doesn't cover him exactly, but it covers our eyes, just as the clouds in the sky cover our eyes and disallow us from seeing the sun. And thereby, agya, the ignorance, adhoktajam, he who is beyond the range of material conception, avayam, na, lakshashe, not observe, the ignorant people who are trapped in the material conception cannot see him, although he is everywhere, because this curtain of maya covers their eyes. And Prabhupada gave the hint at the end of that purport, of the last purport, of what the cause of the curtains being there, or on the, from looking at it from the other side, how to get the curtain removed. He reserves the right of not being exposed to persons who are not surrendered souls. The curtain always remains down for those who aren't surrendered, and the result is that their eyes are covered. Our eyes are covered. My eyes are covered. So what is the obvious solution? So, and that just happens to be what Krishna suggests at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. Sarvadamam pratyaja. Mame kam sharanam raja. So being beyond the range of the, of limited sense perception, you're at hokshaja. We cannot see him, even if we take our minds and apply it, even if we have the greatest minds, we can possibly get a glimpse that he exists, like the great, great scientists of the world. They can glimpse his existence. The puny scientists, the mediocre scientists, who aren't great, they will become atheists. But the actual greatest scientists, even in the material world, they can understand that this, these kind of things do not happen by chance, the way that the world exists. And the scientists, in their own amazing way, they want to see God in the greatest, and they want to see God in the smallest. He is inside of everything, and he's outside of everything. So they'll take an atom smasher and they'll... How big are the big atom smashers? The great cyclotrons? They're tens of miles, and they just use magnetic or other forces to like... It's very, very primitive what they do, these cyclotrons. They use forces. They take these small particles, atomic particles, and they just speed them up and speed them up and speed them up and speed them up, and then they take an atom and they stick it out and they smash it into it to see what it breaks. And this is their method of seeing what's inside of everything. So if you think about it, that Krishna is inside of everything, it's quite demonic, isn't it? They will never find Krishna in that way, no matter how fast they speed it up and smash it into, and then they take the particles, they break it apart, an atom or whatever apart, and then they take one of those particles and they put it out there, and then they take a smaller particle and they speed it up and speed it up and boom, and break that apart. And in this way, they're trying to break everything apart just to find out God, Krishna, who is inside of everything. But this method will not work. There is another method. That will be spoken of here, why they can't... Exactly, Prabhupada will speak about this methodology, the experimental methodology to find God. So, you are invisible, the second half of the verse says. You are invisible. Here is an example that will help us understand. You are invisible to the foolish observer, the agya, one who has no... The muda drisha, the one who is has donkey-like vision, foolish observer, exactly as an actor dressed as a player is not recognized. So when the actor is on stage, the foolish people become so involved in the drama, they forget who he is. And sometimes the actor, he becomes illusioned himself and forgets who he is. But the people don't recognize him because of his costume and the way he, his makeup and the way he speaks and the way he acts his part. The people in the audience don't recognize him, who he actually is. Even though if someone really knows him, it's fully clear to him. Here's Prabhupada's purport. We'll read the entirety of it. In the Bhagavad Gita, now there's going to be, before we get about two-thirds of the way through, Prabhupada will give two reasons why the foolish, the mudadrisha, they can never see Krishna. And as soon as I finish those, I'll ask who can say what they are. In the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada's purport, Lord Sri Krishna affirms that less intelligent persons mistake him to be an ordinary man like us. This is clearly there, and one can understand why. If one doesn't have knowledge, there Krishna is. He's on the chariot. He's using a chariot driver. He looks how old? Maybe 25 years old. Maybe 25 years old. But he's the oldest person. He doesn't have a long beard. I once heard a lecture where I think it was Vidyananda Maharaj said the conception of God as an old man with a beard is interesting, and he examined that, saying, how, when you conceive of God with an old man, as an old man with a beard, how old is he? He's sitting on a throne, beard. How old is he? Maybe he's like 90 or 97. Well, no. But how old does he look? He has a big beard, right? But he's still there. His body isn't completely turned to dust. So he's like 97 years old or something like that. Or maybe 103. Or maybe at most 105. So God is obviously not 105 years old. He's at least thousands and thousands and thousands of years old. So if he can stop aging at 103, if he has the ability to stop aging at 103, why can't he stop aging at 16 or 17 or 20? Because if he was thousands and thousands of years old, how wrinkled would his body be? How long would his beard be? But they don't conceive of him like that. They conceive of him as like 90 or something like that. So it's a funny conception. So if you had a choice, which would you rather stop aging at? 103 or 16? So if, yes, there's an honest person. It's natural. Because we are parts and parcel of the Navayovanam. But there he is, standing or sitting on the chariot. So less intelligent persons who have no knowledge, mistake him to be an ordinary man like us, and thus they deride him. The same is confirmed herein by Queen Kunti. The less intelligent persons are those who rebel against the authority of the Lord. Such persons are known as asuras. So Prabhupada would always give them, the people who don't accept the authority of Krishna, that title of asses or foolish or rascals, mudha, rascals. The asuras or demons, the asuras cannot recognize the Lord's authority. When the Lord himself appears amongst us as Rama, Nrisimha, Varaha, or in his original form as Krishna, he performs many wonderful acts which are humanly impossible. As we shall find in the 10th canto of this great literature, Lord Sri Krishna exhibited his humanly impossible activities even from the days of his lying on the lap of his mother. He killed the Putana witch, although she smeared her breast with poison just to kill the Lord. The Lord sucked out her breast like a natural baby, and he sucked out her very life also. Similarly, he lifted the Govardhan hill just as a boy picks up a frog's umbrella or a mushroom and stood several days continuously just to give protection to the residents of Vrindavan. These are some of the superhuman activities of the Lord described in the authoritative Vedic literatures like the Puranas, Itihas, histories, and Upanishads. So, when Prabhupada would be questioned, well, who is God? Or he would say, we will tell you who God is, it is Krishna. Well, then naturally people would say, especially when he was talking to Westerners, well, how do you know that Krishna is God? And this was the answer that Prabhupada would give. He would say, because the scriptures say so. Well, then the next question is what? Well, yeah. Yeah, good, say it. Well, how do you know that the scriptures are right? Because anyone can write an old book and say, you could say that anything is God. Anyone could write a book and say something is God, and nowadays people do that. I once actually read it. I was in a bookstore. Luckily, I didn't buy this one. But I was, and it said that, like, the secret formula of all success. So I looked through it, and it was saying, if you know this first chapter, if you know this secret formula, this will happen to you. This wonderful thing will happen to you. And second chapter, this wonderful thing. And it was saving for the secret formula right for the end. And then the next to last chapter, it said, and this secret formula is only three words. Yeah. You are God. same old stuff. if you only know that you are God, everything. Then how did I get into this ridiculous situation that I have to buy this silly book to find out if I'm God? So anyone can write any silly book. So how do we know that the scriptures aren't a silly book? So Prabhupada answers, this is the way he would answer that question. Just the way he'll answer it now. He has shown marvelous capacities. Oh, no, one more line up. He has accepted, these are the some of the superhuman activities of the Lord described in the authoritative Vedic literatures, like the Puranas, Itihas, histories, and Upanishads. He has delivered wonderful instructions in the shape of the Bhagavad Gita. He has shown marvelous capacities as a hero, as a householder, as a teacher, and as a renouncer. He is accepted as the Supreme Personality of Godhead by such authoritative personalities as Vyas, Devala, Asita, Narad, Madhva, Shankara, Ramaluja, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, and all other authorities of the line. So this is what Prabhupada would say, that the scriptures are authentic, they're accepted by these powerful personalities who are great teachers, whose character was impeccable. They are not liars, they are not cheaters, nor are they fools. They spent their whole life devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They are not fools. They accepted the scriptures. And therefore, we accept the scriptures. Continues, Prabhupada continues. He himself has declared as much in many places of the authentic literatures. He himself says there is no other personality in any accepted scripture that says that he is God, he is the Supreme Lord. Son of God, yes. Servant of God, yes. But not as the Supreme Lord himself. Only Krishna says that. Now, Prabhupada continues, because clearly some people don't accept Krishna as the Supreme Lord. Why is it? Prabhupada continues, and he's going to give two reasons. And yet, there is a class of men with demoniac mentality. This is what happens when you're the temple president. Please sign this check and this voucher. And yet there's a class of men with demoniac mentality who are always reluctant to accept the Lord as the Supreme Absolute Truth. Why? What causes them to have this demoniac mentality? And I can attest, it's not only them who has the demonic mentality. It's the tendency. This is partially due to their poor fund of knowledge and partially due to their stubborn obstinacy. It's not only that no one ever told them, but there's other factors as well. Stubborn and obstinate, and the demonic mentality states we don't like to accept the authority of the great acharyas and the teachers and the scriptures, even when it comes to things beyond our capacity to understand. Such persons could not recognize, this is partially due to their poor fund of knowledge and partially due to their stubborn obstinacy, which results from various misdeeds in past and present. There is sinful activities sitting in our heart. Yesham Tvantakata Papam Jananam Punya Karmanam. One has to be free from sin. One has to be full of punya, piety, to have the cleanliness of heart and consciousness to accept Krishna properly and simply and fully. So this result, this has come from the poor fund of knowledge and the obstinacy, stubborn obstinacy, comes from various misdeeds in the past and the present. The heart is clouded, the consciousness is covered. So what is the cure for that in this horrible age of Kali, where everyone is so covered and everyone has been cheated so many times by authorities that we have all the reasons that we could ever need to reject any authority who says, "I am the authority." So what is the cure? But below that level is, you know, that's what the mind is saying, but below that level is the level of the sins. So what's the cure? Yes, chanting Hare Krishna. We must chant Hare Krishna, and we must chant without offense if we wish to cleanse our heart properly. Such persons could not recognize Sri Krishna even when he was present before them. So even if God stood before us, Krishna stood before us with flute or whatever, and said, "I'm like this," and we'd say, "How do I know you're really God?" Because if the heart isn't pure, Kamsa saw Krishna. So many people saw, the wrestlers saw Krishna, they tried to kill him. Krishna wrestles Vaisa. So it takes something else too. Another reason coming up. Another difficulty. So what was that difficulty? Yeah. Huh? Yes, caused by contamination. Impure heart. But not questions yet. Because another difficulty is that those who depend more on their imperfect senses cannot realize Him as the Supreme Lord using the ascending process. Such persons are like the modern scientists. They want to know everything by their experimental knowledge. But Krishna is a Rokshaja. But it is not possible to know the Supreme Lord by imperfect experimental knowledge. He is described here in his Adhoktaja. We could take atom smashers and make them as big as the whole world and spin quarks and subgluons or whatever and just spin everything around and around and speed them up and smash them into things and find more, and we'll never, never, never uncover Krishna in that way. He is described here in his Adhoktaja, or beyond the range of experimental knowledge. All our senses are imperfect. We claim to observe everything and anything, and we have full faith in what we see. But we must admit that we can observe things only under certain material conditions only, which are also beyond our control. The Lord is beyond the observation of sense perception. Queen Kunti accepts this deficiency of the conditioned soul, especially of the woman class. Ooh, that's not politically correct, Prabhupada. What are we going to do? Who are less intelligent. What to speak of that being politically? Prabhupada, I've noticed that he's not very politically correct on many, many occasions. For the less intelligent men, oh, the men are also less intelligent, there must be things such as temples, mosques, or churches so that they may begin to recognize the authority of the Lord and hear about him from authorities in such holy places. So here is the solution. We cannot find him by our experimental knowledge. Then everyone, it must be said, is less intelligent in the sense that they don't have the capacity to find Krishna. So Krishna so kindly has the places of worship and especially what should happen in the places of worship is there should be hearing from the scriptures and the sadhus about Krishna. And then about God. And then gradually, intelligence revived, the heart purified. And then gradually one can see him, not just one time, but premanjana charita bhakti valochanena. Not at any time will one be not able to see him if one's heart is pure and if one possesses prema. That is the magic wand, as Prabhupada said, that allows us to see Krishna everywhere. And the beginning, and it will continue, is the hearing process. Hearing. Iyan malish seichi nitya shravanadi jal. This continuously, the creeper of our devotion must be sprinkled with the water of hearing and chanting. For less intelligent men, this beginning of spiritual life is essential, and only foolish men decry the establishment of such places of worship, which are required to raise the standard of spiritual attributes for the mass of people. Foolish people will say, God is everywhere. Why do we need a temple? He's everywhere. First of all, if he's everywhere, why isn't he in the temple also? And second of all, he may be everywhere, but who can see him everywhere? Who has that kind of vision? So the temples are required for less intelligent persons. Bowing down, I'm going to ask, what does this sentence mean? For less intelligent persons, bowing down before the authority of the Lord, as generally done in the temples, mosques, or churches, is as beneficial as it is for the advanced devotees to meditate upon him by active service. What does that sentence mean? As beneficial. Did you? Yes. Yes. But what does this mean? That's a nice point. But what does this mean that the for a person on this level, bowing down in the temple is as beneficial as for the advanced devotees to meditate on him through active service? And it's also interesting to hear how active service, meditate on him through active service. What an interesting concept, that active service should be devotional service, seva, not work. It's a way to meditate on him, to please him. Then it's seva, then it's wonderful. So what does it mean, these two? Yes, you want to? Yes. But why one is beneficial and the other is, one is this, Prabhupada is equating the two. That's what I'm asking about. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Doing, yes. This is the way teachers see. A teacher has a different concept of good than other people. A teacher sees that if a person is going forward, taking a step forward, a student is taking a step forward, that is how he defines good. He's doing well. So this is a step forward for this first grade student, and he's doing very well. And The act of service is a step forward for another grade of student. And he's doing very well. And to compare the two grades of students and saying this one's good and this one's not good, that is not good. Because it doesn't. Students need to be encouraged. Is it a comment or a question? Okay, then why don't we wait till after, because I'm already going so slow. Next verse. Now, this Krishna, again, he can't be seen due to Maya, even though he's everywhere. Why does he come? Why is he sitting there? Why does he appear? Ta-ta. And who does he come for? What is the purpose of his coming? And who does he come for? Who does he come to help? Tata, everyone together. Tata paramahamsanam muninam apmalatmanam bhakti yoga vidanartam katam pashema histriya. You yourself descend to propagate the transcendental science of devotional service into the hearts of the advanced transcendentalists and mental speculators, the paramhamsas, the munis, those who are already above the bodily concept of life. Krishna so kindly comes because they're not attached in the material world. They're paramhamsas. They know the essence of what the material world is for. They're munis. They've picked out, they've understood that this material world is not a place for enjoyment. Dukalayama shashvatam. So Krishna comes for these advanced souls to... They're purified by being able to discriminate between matter and spirit. They're already advanced souls. You've come for them, Kunti Devi says. And then she says, how then can we women who don't have that discriminative ability know you perfectly? Prabhupada's purport. Even the greatest philosophical speculators cannot have access to the region of the Lord. It is said in the Upanishads that the supreme truth, the absolute personality of Godhead, is beyond the range of the thinking power of the greatest philosopher. He is unknowable by great learning or the greatest brain. He is knowable only by one who has his mercy. And this is the process of bhakti. The science of how, somehow or another, how can one get Krishna's mercy? It's causeless mercy. That means that no one in and of themselves can force it, because it's freely given by Krishna. But what can a soul do to attract causeless mercy? We can do nothing more than attract it. The rest is up to Krishna. What can one do? That's the science of Krishna. He is knowable only by one who has his mercy. Others may go on thinking about him for years together, yet he is unknowable. This very fact is corroborated by the queen, who is playing the part of an innocent woman. Women in general are unable to speculate like philosophers, but they are blessed by the Lord because they believe at once in the superiority and almightiness of the Lord, and thus they offer obeisances without reservation. The Lord is so kind that he does not show special favor only to one who is a great philosopher. He knows the sincerity of purpose. The sincerity. One time, I think it was in 1966, I think it was Brahmananda who asked Prabhupada, he was asking about this philosopher, and is this philosopher Krishna conscious, Western philosopher? Is he Krishna conscious, and is this one Krishna conscious, and is this one Krishna conscious? And Prabhupada's reply was, his sincerity is his Krishna consciousness. How much one is sincere amidst all the other faults and debilities, maybe, but one's sincerity is one's Krishna consciousness. That's why one should be very careful in judging others, and should, as the general principle is, not to judge and criticize others. We leave that to Guru and Krishna to to judge the sincerity of others. And if it happens to be one's service to correct, he knows the sincerity of purpose. And as we hope that Krishna is very lenient when he judges us, we should consider that point when we may not be so lenient in judging others. We are hoping on one hand again that Krishna is in a good mood when our record, he calls it up on the computer from the database. We hope that he is in a very liberal and lenient mood. For this reason only, women generally assemble in great numbers in any sort of religious function. In every country, in every sect of religion, it appears that the women are more interested than the men. This simplicity of acceptance of the Lord's authority is more effective than showy, insincere religious fervor. So how, she asks, you're invisible, how can you be known? We don't have the ability, playing the part of a less intelligent woman with not the power to dissect the mind from the body and then slow the mind down and then understand the self as soul, not the body, to extract the consciousness from the mind and the body. How can we know you? And the hint will be given in her next sloka. Krishna, everyone. Krishnaya Vasudevaya Devakinandanaya cha Nanda Gopakumaraya Govindaya namo namah. Again. Krishnaya Vasudevaya Devakinandanaya cha Nanda Gopa Kumaraya Govindaya namo namah. Because Krishna here, these are all primary names of Krishna. What's the difference between a primary name of Krishna and a secondary name of Krishna? Yes, but what's the actual difference? Yes. Yes. That's the primary names are Krishna's name in relationship with devotees and his pastimes, and the secondary names are in relationship to the material. He's the creator. Yes, like that. Yes, so the names of Krishna in relationship to his devotees, that's what's given here. So this is a hint that we can, if we become, Krishna relates to his devotees, so despite our debilities, if we become devotees, or better than that, devotees of devotees, then we also, despite our lack of intelligence, can know Krishna by his mercy. Let me therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto the Lord, who has become the son of Vasudev, the pleasure of Devaki, the boy of Nanda and the other cowherd men of Vrindavan, and the enlivener of the cows and senses. Oh, I wanted to read that, but I wanted to get up to 22, so I won't read the Prabhupada's purport. The Prabhupada's purport is very sweet. He describes the names of Krishna and their meaning, these names that are given here. Krishnaya Vasudevaya Devakinandanaya Cha Nanda Gopakumaraya Govindaya Namo. Lord Krishna as Govinda is more inclined to the brahmanas and the cows, indicating thereby that human prosperity depends more or less on these two items, namely Brahminical culture and cow protection. Lord Krishna is never satisfied where these are lacking. Now, in the last verse we shall read today, if Krishna allows us, Nama Pankajanabhaya Nama Pankajamalane Nama Pankajanetraya
Namaste Pankajangraye.
My respectful obeisances are unto you, O Lord, whose abdomen is marked with a depression like a lotus flower, who are always decorated with garlands of lotus flowers, whose glance is as cool as the lotus, and whose feet are engraved with lotuses. Srila Jiva Goswami comments that Kunti Devi compares Krishna to the lotus, indicating Krishna's capacity to bring happiness to mankind. And Krishna is always compared to a lotus. We say he has lotus feet, or we say that Srila Prabhupada has lotus feet, or the great devotees have lotus feet, because the lotus has the wonderful characteristic of its leaves have a waxy sheen to them, a waxy covering. And the water, when water comes on it, on these leaves, it immediately comes off. The water never actually touches the lotus. Or when the lotus is growing in the pond, it may appear to be in the water, but it's actually above it. So similarly, Krishna and his and every aspect of Krishna, from his lotus abdomen to his lotus garland to his lotus-like glance and lotus feet, they actually have nothing to do with the material world. He descends, we say he descends to the material world, but actually Krishna never comes to the material world. He never touches the material world. The material energy always stays so far from him. Krishna never descends into the material world, but nor is he an incarnation in the sense of the actual, that's the word we use. We translate avatar to mean incarnation. But he is never incarnate, he is never within flesh. He is always transcendental. His lotus feet never touch the material world. Padam ekam nagacchati Vrindavanam prityaja. Krishna never actually takes one step out of Vrindavan. Prabhupada's purport. Here are some of the specific symbolic marks on the spiritual body of the personality of Godhead, which distinguish his body from the bodies of all others. Because again, Krishna comes, and this person is fully transcendental. He is out of this world. His body is composed of eternity, bliss, and knowledge, not flesh and bones and lymph glands and blood. They are all special features of the body of the Lord. The Lord may appear as one of us, but he is always distinct by his specific bodily features. Srimati Kunti claims herself unfit to see the Lord because of her being a woman. This is claimed because women, sudras, the laborer class, and the dvija bandhus, or the wretched descendants of the higher three classes, are unfit by intelligence to understand transcendental subject matter concerning the spiritual names, fame, attributes, form of the supreme of the supreme absolute truth. Such persons, although they are unfit to enter into the spiritual affairs of the Lord, can see him as the Archa-Vigraha, who descends on the material world just to distribute favors to the fallen souls, including the above-mentioned women, sudras, and dvija bandhus. Because such fallen souls cannot see anything beyond matter, the Lord condescends to enter into each and every one of the innumerable universes as the Garbhadakshay Vishnu, who grows a lotus stem from the lotus-like depression at the center of his transcendental abdomen, and thus Brahma, the first living being in the universe, is born. Therefore, the Lord is known as the Pankajanabi. The Pankajanabi Lord accepts the Archa-Vigraha, his transcendental form, in different elements, namely a form within the mind, a form made of wood, a form made of earth, a form made of metal, a form made of a jewel, a form made of paint, a form drawn on sand, etc. All such forms of the Lord are always decorated with garlands of lotus flowers, and there should be a soothing atmosphere in the temple of worship to attract the burning attention of the non-devotees always engaged in material wranglings. So Prabhupada's answer to the question of how can we, less intelligent fools and rascals who don't have the actual qualification to see Krishna, to be able to dissociate ourselves fully from matter, is the deity, the Archavigra, who, although is made out of metal, or stone, or mind, or jewel, or wood, is nonetheless the Lord, and that is His special mercy that He comes in this form. So, Prabhupada said that everyone knows that the deity is made out of stone, but to think He is just stone is an offense. That is, because yes, He is made out of stone, but by breaking the stone, as the Muslims tried to do to so many deities in Vrindavan, that does not kill the Lord at all. He is stone, but He's not only stone. He so kindly condescends out of His mercy. He incarnates as the Archavigraha. All such forms of the Lord should... to attract the burning attention of the non-devotees always engaged in material wrangling, the suffering. As soon as a materialistic person sees the beautiful form, there's so many stories of this. I once heard how one, the person at Bhaktivedanta Manor, when they just got the manor, some person, inspector, came in and they said, and he wanted to see he was confirming the purpose of the building. That was what it was, and he was going in with his clipboard and inspecting this and that, and they brought him to the temple room, and this is our place of worship, you have to take off your shoes. So he went in with his clipboard and he stood in front of the deities, Radhagokulananda, and he came out and said, I never expected it to be like this. You have to be a real hardcore atheist demon not to get affected by deities who are properly worshipped, like Radhagokulananda, Radhashyama Sundar, and so many of the wonderful deities all over the world, Radha Balava, Radha Gopinath. Who did I miss? I don't want to offend anyone. So many, yes. So many wonderful deities. Just immediately. So that's Krishna's mercy. The meditators worship a form within the mind. Therefore, the Lord is merciful even to the women, sudras, and dvijabandhus, provided they agree to visit the temple of worship in different forms made for them. Such temple visitors are not idolaters, as alleged by some men with a poor fund of knowledge. All the great acharyas established such temples of worship in all places just to favor the less intelligent, and one should not pose himself as transcending the stage of temple worship while one is actually in the category of the sudras and the women or less. One should begin to see the Lord from his lotus feet, gradually rising to the thighs, waist, chest, and face. One should not try to look at the face of the Lord without being accustomed to seeing the lotus feet of the Lord. Srimati Kunti, because of her being the aunt of the Lord, the aunt of the Lord, did not begin to see the Lord from the lotus feet because the Lord might feel ashamed. And thus Kunti Devi, just to save a painful situation for the Lord, began to see the Lord just above his lotus feet, from the waist of the Lord, gradually rising to the face, and then down to the lotus feet. In the round, everything there is in. So if one is unable to understand the Lord by intelligence only, one can easily understand Him by His causeless mercy in the form of Archavigraha. Now, in class tomorrow, I'll just say one word about these next verses. That there's a very interesting twist of philosophy that comes up. Or not a twist of philosophy, but yes, say that, but a twist in Kunti Devi's prayers, and a twist a philosophical change in the how the Bhagavatam is developing, and it's going to make a still more wonderful point, because up to this point we've seen how Krishna protects his devotees in every way. Oh, I won't say too much about it right now, but tomorrow we shall hear more. Kunti Devi will say something very wonderful, many wonderful things. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srimati Kunti Devi ki jai, Sri Krishna ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. They didn't see him as Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You mean, when they have material vision, what do they see? They see as if matter. Just like one who sees the deity with material vision, one can see matter. But one who has pure love and devotion, he can see the deity in a completely different way if he has great faith and devotion. Of course, the material energy also comes from Krishna, so that's all one would see. It's actually also described when Krishna saw, when Krishna, there's a famous verse in the 10th canto, maybe you could find it, when Krishna walked into the wrestling arena of Kamsa, there were different personalities there, and the different personalities saw him in different ways. Some saw him as the most beautiful, attractive person. Others saw him as death personified. So, yes. But they didn't see it as spiritual. So you're saying, what was it really? Was it spiritual or material, what they saw? They saw material, just like if you have a blue lens, blue sunglasses, what will you see? You'll see blue everywhere. So if one has materialistic mind, one will only see blue or matter, because it's a covering. This is the covering, Maya Javani Katshanam. It's the covering of Maya. So Krishna can stand in front of us with a transcendental body and we'll still see Maya. We'll still see matter because of the nature of the lens covering our eyes. Because one sees, just like if we see, just like a mother walks outside and she sees her child's shoes. We see shoes. She goes, ah, what are these shoes doing over there? But because of the bhava of the mother, she sees, her heart melts and she sees her child. So everything depends on the heart, the condition of the heart, and that depends on purity. With material eyes? No. Therefore, the scientists, their attempt with the cyclotrons and everything, we cannot see anything, but we cannot see Krishna properly. You need spiritualized. That's why that verse, Prem Anjana, the eyes have to be Velochanena, the eyes have to be coated with prema. One has to be a devotee to see Krishna. And yeah, you're not going to be able to get very much more out of me on this one. I'm like, you know, what is it exactly that they're actually seeing? You know? Right. Could we also see the residents of the spiritual world with ordinary eyes? No. No, but not recognized means you see them material. You'll see everything material if you have material consciousness. Everything depends on the consciousness. If you're in a bad mood, you see only bad things happen to you continuously. There's a teaching technique like this. Yes, you see something. You see yourself. You see, this is called projection. There's a psychological principle. Basically, when we see the world, we're basically only seeing our own consciousness. No, we're seeing, not according to our conscience. Actually, we're seeing our own consciousness. A dog sees whatever, I don't remember what they see. But dog only, he sees bones and enemies and friends. That's all he sees because he has a dogish mind. There's a teaching technique that, and it's very, very powerful. So many times, you come, because I was a Gurukul teacher, you come into class and you're in a bad mood. And you see the kids that, they're, stop doing that, stop doing that. Everyone's only doing things that are wrong. And then the teaching technique is, you have to start seeing good things that they're doing. No matter if 99% of what a kid is doing is wrong, and you can't find anything good, you have to find something good. So you can say, boy, you're really breathing really nicely today. If you can't find anything else, this is great breathing, great job of breathing you're doing. As soon as you start seeing differently and seeing good, suddenly the world shifts and good things start happening. Because really you're only seeing your mind. Really that's all we see. We're projecting our mind upon everything. So this person is our enemy. He's done this person, he's bad and he does this and this and this. And usually the thing that you really, when someone, especially if there's something about someone that really bothers you, you know, there's some people, you know, as soon as you see them, there's characteristics that you really, and you're seeing something of yourself in them. And there's something about you that's glaring. This is just material psychology. Really, we only see our own, that's all we have the capacity to see. No. Well, while we're in the material energy, we're gifted with a certain set of filters over our eyes. And then we get when our eyes and heart are open, then by Krishna's grace, we can see Him. And when our consciousness is love, then we see Krishna, love of Krishna. Ladini Shakti, Chit Shakti, Sambit. When we get that type of lens, then we'll see Krishna. Even Krishna. How otherwise when this is like Sisupal, what did he see? He was gifted with he had a particular consciousness of enmity, and all he saw was faults in Krishna, and he named them one after another because his consciousness was like that. It's actually a very heavy concept. This concept. It's very heavy. So what is reality, actually? And you see this with, you have two countries that are really, they're fighting and they hate each other. And you ask them, and from an outsider, you say, why don't they just compromise or something? But you ask this one and this side, well, it's all this person, it's all this person, it's all this side, it's all this side. And then you ask this side, it's all this side, it's all this side, it's all this side. It's like they have different heads or something. They have, they have just completely different lenses, consciousness. So therefore they see reality completely different. So what is reality? They don't actually see reality, they just have different versions of illusion. And that's what the material world is, different versions of illusion. So when Krishna comes, what is the meaning of avajananti mammudha, manushyam tanam ashrita? Materialistic people, when they're mudas, they say Krishna is an ordinary person. Parambhavam ajananto, they don't know who I am. I'm saving you for last in the sense that you have questions to answer too. You want to... And then we'll let you go. Yes. So what is the full model of reality? That is Goloka Vrindavan. And from that point, viewpoint, because viewpoint means a view from a point. So from that viewpoint, then everything else makes sense. Yeah, illusion is shared illusion. But reality is something different. Okay, bless. Question and then. Oh, why did you have to bring that up? Especially if you say stubborn obstinacy. I was hoping we'd avoid that. From time immemorial. One time I, even in Prabhupada's presence, that's what, very hard to be in the presence of an extremely pure soul over a long period of time. I asked Prabhupada, when I was with him one time, I said, sometimes in your presence, one feels completely liberated. And at other times, just sort of the same. As you know, under the cloud of material nature. I asked why? And he said that the intoxication of Maya is very strong. This is sort of what you're saying also. We tend to, we're attached, we're holding on, you know, it's holding on to us and we're holding on to it in that sense. Until one is pure. So generally when we talk in a general way, we say, you know, we devotees, what are the devotees doing today? But more accurately, it's aspiring devotees. Technically, we're aspiring to be Vaishnavas, devotees. Because a devotee is one who has actually attained the shelter of the internal energy and has given up the shelter of the external energy. Yes? No, we can go forever. I have an idea.
So the Samana Bharadvajarishi fell into the hollow of a bamboo, and from there was born Drona. As per the instructions of his father, Dronacharya married Kripi, daughter of the sage Saradvata. The good-natured Kripi gave birth to Ashwatthama, as per Mahabharata, chapter 130 of the Adi Parva. The moment he was born, he made a loud hoot, like Uchaishravas. Yeah. And the sound resembled the braying of a horse. Immediately a voice from heaven said that the boy should be named Ashwatthama. The boy was therefore named so, from shlokas 48 and 49 of chapter 130. So in training, Ashwatthama took his lessons in archery from his father Drona. At that time, Drona got new lessons from Parashurama, and they were also imparted to Drona's disciples. When Drona became the preceptor of the Kauravas and the Pandavas, then Ashwatthama also went with him. There were shlokas 52 to 64 of the same Mahabharata. So Drona was very affectionate to his son and wanted to teach him something special in archery. So he used to instruct him during the time the other disciples went to fetch water for the ashrama. Arjuna came to know of this, and he thereafter started bringing his quota of water very quickly enough to join the special class of Drona. Thus, Arjuna and Ashwatthama learned a lot more than the others in the military art. Shlokas 17 through 19 of chapter 132. So it mentions about in the Mahabharata who Ashwatthama participated in the Raja Sabha, the Rajasuya of Yudhisthira. Then it mentions later on about the fighting of the war, who he killed, and it mentions in a Malayalam version of Mahabharata, it says there that when he went to the, after Dhrishtadyumna killed his father, he became so enraged, he said that he immediately went to the camp of the Pandavas. This is the distinction in that edition. And he saw Bhuta, saw an intense ghost that blocked the way. And the ghost was extremely powerful. Very intense. Description here is very intense. Undaunted, Ashwatthama showered divine arrows on this figure, but the ghost and his supreme powers absorbed the arrows the moment it touched him. So Ashwatthama meditated on Lord Shiva, and the latter appeared before him in person and gave him a divine dagger. So with that, he entered the bedchamber of Drishtadyumna, woke him up by kicking him with his foot, caught hold of him by the hairs in his head and killed him. No, it says Ashwatthama and his jewel. The anger of Ashwatthama did not abate even after killing Drishtadyumna, the butcher of his father. With a view of destroying the whole Pandava dynasty, he sent the Pandavas, the all-powerful Brahma Shirastra. But Drona had given the same type of missile to Arjuna also, and so he sent forth his to meet the other. And it created such a great explosion that all the elders on both the sides joined together and requested them to withdraw the missiles. Arjuna demanded the jewel on the head of Ashwatthama to withdraw his missile. Ashwatthama's missile, evidently. Or to withdraw his own missile. I can't understand that. But Ashwatthama refused to part with the jewel. Ashwatthama said, "This jewel of mine is more valuable than all the wealth of both the Pandavas and the Kauravas put together. If you wear this, you need not be afraid of enemies, disease, hunger, and thirst, and no harm will come to you from the Yakshas, Nagas, or thieves. And I'll never part with such a jewel." This is Shloka 28-30 of Mahabharata, chapter 15, Sutanika Parva. Then after great persuasion, Ashwatthama surrendered his jewel, but without withdrawing the missile, directed that missile toward the womb of Uttara, who was bearing a child then. Now we are reminded of an incident which happened when the Pandavas were residing in Upaplavya. A poor Brahmin looking at Uttara said, "When the Kauravas will be weakened in power, a child will be born to you. The boy will have to bear a test even while in the womb, and so you must name the child Parikshit, one who has been tested." Parikshit, one who has been tested in this definition. So, when the powerful missile was flying straight toward Uttara's womb, Sri Krishna said, "Even though the child in the womb will die of this arrow, it will be reborn. O Ashwatthama, you'll be denounced by all as a sinner for killing this unborn child. To suffer for this evil deed, you'll roam about in the earth for 3,000 years. Nobody will associate with you. You'll be shunned by society. You'll be tormented by all the diseases on earth. But the child, which you have now killed, will become a famous scholar and a brave king. He'll rule this country for 60 years. He'll be known as the next Kuru Raja. Look, I'm giving life to this child you've killed." Vyasadeva supported Krishna, and Ashwatthama, repenting on his hasty action, gave the jewel to the Pandavas and left for the forest with Vyasadeva. Shotika Parva Mahabharata. So there you have it. About the jewel? Does it mention about the jewel? Yeah. They cut his jewel off. Bhagavatam is only the cream. Actually, sometimes some of the details you have to go to Bhagavatam. The action's there sometimes. The mundane action. And the rest of it we'll do later. The rest of it I'll do later. I still haven't had a chance to talk with Radha Govinda Maharaj about the other one. The astra was directed at all of them or only then? Five or six astras, separate astras. I have to look. He didn't say nothing about that there. And this didn't mention anything about that detail.